This is HPR episode 2475 entitled Information Underground, Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, and is part of the series Information Underground. It is hosted by Lost in Bronx and is about 43 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is: the IU guys examined the first sexual revolution in America back during Prohibition. Today's show is licensed under a CC0 license.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Welcome, listeners, to Information Underground on Hacker Public Radio. I'm Deep Geek, and I have with me Lawson Bronx.
Hello, everyone.
And Klaatu.
Hello, everybody.
And today, what the topic I would like to open up is the Roaring Twenties and Prohibition Era as the first sexual revolution. So, a quick note on the beginning of this topic, we were recording another episode where Hugh Hefner came up in a poor light, and I felt the need to defend him in some way. And so I mentioned that he was the forerunner of the second American sexual revolution. And you might say to yourself, what? The second sexual revolution? Wasn't it the only one, the hippies with the sex and the drugs and the rock and roll in the 60s? Well, it happened before. I am utterly fascinated by the American prohibition of alcohol in the years 1920 to 1933 because it is a culmination of many things and truly a changed America's character. America had a truly puritanical character with most of the features we today call patriarchal. Women were non-working, stay-at-home homemakers with zero political say. Courtship was a formal process involving permissions and chaperoning. Prior to the 1920s, according to one survey, only 14% of women had premarital sex before the age of 25, while 34% of women who came of age in the 1910s and 20s reported that they had lost their virginity prior to marriage. The biggest problem in the eyes of many housewives prior to the 20s were the saloons. Dirty, male-only establishments where many married men would literally drink away the money needed for the household. This led to a temperance movement aimed against saloons. However, when the Christian women's temperance movement found allies with rural Protestant ethics about sobriety coupled with anti-immigrant and anti-black prejudices, a powerful political force was established for the 18th Amendment. Wives thought they would get rid of the saloon. Whites thought blacks would get deprived of drink. Americans thought immigrants would be deprived of drink. Soft liquor drinkers thought hard liquor was being illegalized. People were truly surprised that after the 18th Amendment and the Volstead Act, that they were deprived of their own favorite vice as well as their perceived enemies. Here's the rub. Speakeasies rose simultaneously with the 19th Amendment, women having the right to vote. This resulting in modern political women being a possibility. Speakeasies didn't care about the gender of their clients, and this led to dating because men and women could now escape being chaperoned. A private movie and dinner and drink was now possible, and with taxis and cars, private transport while out in public was a possibility too. Prohibition, the first sexual revolution, jazz was the rock and roll, liquor was the drugs, and flappers were the sex. After Prohibition, we had dating, but we still had an amazingly repressive sexual attitude that would not change until a normalization of pornography in the late 50s. This led to an open dialogue about sexuality and a variety of changes. Quickly on the heels of the normalization of pornography came shifts in attitude regarding fantasy and masturbation, women's sexuality, premarital sexuality, and homosexuality. And that's how I want to get into the topic. And I suppose, guys, this could go both ways, both in deeper into the prohibition side of the topic and into the change in American womanhood. But let's go from here.
Well, I would like, first off, before we dive into the history of this, I would like you to expand a bit on your defense of Hugh Hefner and how prohibition links to the second sexual revolution. Because I think for a lot of people, that thread might be a little bit thin or a little bit hard to see.
Well, Hugh Hefner got into the publishing industry through Esquire magazine, a well-known men's magazine. But he was also deeply disappointed with it, so he sought out to start his own magazine. And pornography was taboo until that point, until he came on the scene. But he brought with it a philosophical basis and a literary character, as well as pictures of the most beautiful woman of the day in the Raw. And I remember seeing cartoons about Playboy magazine from the 50s, literally cartoons, like political kind of cartoons, showing men waiting for a train and you know, they would have the nose in a copy of Playboy while they wait, and the thought bubble would say, I guess this is okay now, you know? But it greases a groove. Therefore, Hugh Hefner kind of, if there was a boy with the finger in the dike, he's the one who pulled it away. And that's my chief defense of Hugh Hefner.
Okay. Jumping back again a bit.
Now, what exactly is unclear about the role of flappers?
Oh, nothing. I mean, I actually...
Because I could go on.
Yeah, no. I mean, they were raw sexuality for the time.
Yeah.
There's no argument to that at all. Just for the sake of the listeners, we were chatting about this through email for a couple of weeks, actually, leading up to this episode. And one of the things that I mentioned in an email to Deep Geek was I'd like to see a little light shed on... Now, during Prohibition, during the rise of Prohibition, that is where the power of American gangsters really came into play. You know, that's the legacy of the American Mafia. It really rose during Prohibition in America during that time. And in addition to alcohol, they got into an awful lot of other areas, including gambling, prostitution, and pornography. Now, pornography and the rise of video, or I should say film and photography during this time period, and how much easier and smaller all of this equipment became, how much easier it was to operate so that you didn't have to be a photographic expert anymore to actually, you know, use a camera. The Kodak Brownie had popped up at some point during this time. And pornography became more widespread and kind of entrenched in American culture. And a lot of that was controlled by the gangsters during the same time period, so that you had speakeasies that were promoting a more sexually free lifestyle. You also had gangsters, very often gangsters, or at least criminal elements, that were also providing pornography at the same time period. Now, we go, like, say, 1925, we go from pornography being illegal pretty much everywhere, probably pretty much everywhere in the world at that time, to 1955, is that, give or take, when Playboy came out? Something.
I think it was 55. I think it was 52 that Denmark legalized it.
Okay.
I have a book on that someplace in here.
Okay. So in 30 years, we go from a social mindset or a social view where everything about the human body except your face, your hands, and your feet, and your feet have to be in shoes, all of,
yeah,
you know, everything
that
else
was the Victorian standard.
Yeah, those were Victorian standards. And we go from that mindset where those were the only things you could show anybody ever to Hugh Hefner in 30 short years. So,
well, I mean, I think this is an interesting point about the control of all of this, about it being the mafia or whatever, because my problem with Playboy and Hugh Hefner and that sort of industry is that we all have assets that we can capitalize on, whether they're natural skills or whether you don't feel like you have natural skills, but you have a great body or whatever. We all have something, right? And one of the most basic things that we all have is sex. And there's a market for sex. There's a desire for sex. So it's something that you could feasibly bargain with if it were permitted. But something back way back in history, whether it was, I don't know, you can blame religion, you can blame capitalism, you can blame, you know, mind control, the Illuminati, whatever. Something said, oh, no, you can't do that. You can use whatever you want, but not your body. That's a bad thing. That's evil.
Yeah,
and that's how it's been. That's how it's been. So I don't really see sort of one guy, Hugh Hefner, capitalizing on that control as actually being very praiseworthy. And I would equate him with the mafia, because they kind of were doing the same thing, right? They were like, oh, you guys made drinking illegal? Well, we'll manufacture and sell the alcohol then. You know, and it's kind of like that same thing. They're finding loopholes, but the loopholes are always coming back for their benefit. And I don't find that praiseworthy. I don't find it praiseworthy that Bill Gates put a PC in every home because I think he's an evil guy. I don't find it praiseworthy that Steve Jobs made a happy computer. I don't find it praiseworthy that Napoleon unified the culture of Europe by bringing war throughout the whole thing. You know, it's just like I don't look at the result and say, oh, you guys did a good job, because they did it for themselves.
So you feel their motivation matters more than the accomplishment?
Yeah, because I think that I don't think that they solved the problem. I think they brought about, like Deep Geek says, a conversation, and they kind of made it more acceptable. But it's not more acceptable, right? Because Playboy, yeah, sure, it's made pornography somewhat more acceptable. I mean, certainly it's prolific. It's not illegal. But, I mean, the base, the problem still exists, and that is that some people somewhere are saying, hey, you people, you have to be subject to what we say is okay. And we say pornography is okay now, but prostitution's still not okay. You still can't sell your actual body, but you can sell pictures of your body. That's, you know, and it's this deep-rooted problem of someone else being in control over what we can or cannot do.
That problem is deep-rooted, but, I mean, you know, the interesting thing is the function that he serves as an icon. And it goes back also to the first Playboy centerfold, Marilyn Monroe. And there's no reason why you have to think of her as the first sex symbol either, you know, but that's, you know, something that we assign to their character or their role.
Well, she wasn't the first sex symbol. I mean, you were just talking about the flappers. You go back to that era and there were tons of movie stars who were considered sex symbols at the time.
And Josephine Baker, too.
She goes. She goes back
fantastic.
Even further. Yeah, she was amazing. And she, I mean, if you see any pictures of her dancing today, and there is some video as well, or film that survived, I mean, that was an incredibly good-looking woman. She's incredibly hot even today by today's standards. So, you know, Marilyn didn't create that whole concept. However, she was the sex symbol of the day. And the fact that she chose to reveal her, you know, her body in the nude at that time was considered revolutionary, and it helped to add to her mystique and her kind of legend, as it were.
I think a colleague of mine said it very well, that at that juncture in time in America, we needed to have a very high visibility sex object there.
And I think that I think Klaatu hit on the right terminology for this. I think that these people, Hugh Hefner, Marilyn Monroe, these people helped open a dialogue, a general way that we can discuss and approach these changes in our societies, changes that clearly society wanted. I mean, you can argue whether or not someone like Hugh Hefner was a good person, but I don't think that anyone today, any reasonable person today, would look at a woman who wants to wear a tank top on a hot summer day as being immoral or terrible. But you go back a few years before Hefner, and if a woman walked around like that, she would have been arrested for indecent exposure. Now, I've seen photographs from the 1930s where people were being ticketed on Coney Island Beach in New York City for wearing quote-unquote risque bathing suits, right?
But those are bathing suits where they're actually measuring from kneecap to bottom of the
exactly.
suit?
Exactly. And it
wasn't, my God, that picture's so funny.
Yeah, and it wasn't just women. If men were wearing just their trunks without a top on, they were getting tickets. And in such a short time, they went from that to something far less restrictive. By that standard, you know, most women are walking around almost naked today, and many of the men as well. And I don't think anybody would want to go back to a time period when that was different. Any reasonable person, anyway, would want to go back to a time period where that was considered the proper thing in society. Now, you can wear whatever you want that makes you comfortable, but I would never want to live in a society that would view a person negatively for wearing comfortable clothing.
Yeah, so, neither would I. I'm 100% with you on this one.
Yeah. But
I really think that the Roaring Twenties and the Prohibition were the turning point. And to get back to Klaatu's point, no one liked gangsters until Prohibition, when they became kind of a, I guess you would call it a Robin Hood-esque figure, because there are some law passed and people saw that the law was bad way before the halls of government admitted it was bad, and the gangsters were defying it and defying it openly, and people appreciated it, and it made the gangsters less evil in their eyes. How much that applies to pornographers, I don't know, but that's interesting that the law was actually that bad that it made the gangsters look good.
Deep Kick, in my mind, speakeasies, they were very busy places, but they were sort of like underground raves might be considered today, right?
Yes, yes.
And underground raves, while they might have a significant impact culturally on the wider dialogue, because almost everybody has heard about them, but I don't know very many people who've actually ever been to one. One of those things.
Well, I've been to a BAM.
I don't know what that is.
A BAM is when you and 5 to 10 friends or so decide to have a street party, a block party in an impromptu manner, and you literally pull into a cul-de-sac, blocking the road, blast your radios, begin drinking publicly and dancing in the street until you get afraid that the cops are about to come and you split. So I've done that. That's a BAM. BAM, you're there. BAM, you're out.
Okay, well, I've never done that.
Yeah.
My point is speakeasies had a major, major impact on American culture. But how many people actually participated? Can we assume that the average person who had to get up and go to work the next day probably never went to one of these things?
They even to know... The drinks were priced similarly to what drinks are priced now. Probably there was a large proportion of people who were living vicariously through them, who knew of them, you know, and some of it depended on the city. I mean, some of the brownstones, there are stories of brownstones in Manhattan that had to put up signs that said, "We are not a speakeasy. We're trying to sleep. Please do not knock," you know, and I mean, New York, I should say, has always been a very wet city.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how much it carries over to other places, but the speakeasy itself is not isolated to the only venue for drinking.
No, I know. In fact, it was probably in the minority when it came to the amount of alcohol that was being consumed. I know for a fact that there was a lively gray area prescription business being done by many doctors who were prescribing alcohol for quote-unquote medicinal purposes.
That was a phenomena that led to the expansion of Walgreens from a chain of 25 stores to what it is today. They owe it to the fear that was written into the Volstead Act of massive delirium tremens, and doctors were allowed to prescribe, and it was legal. And some of the prescriptions are actually on the internet. You could read them. They're funny. As in, take 1 ounce per hour for stimulation until stimulated. it's absolutely hysterical. What interests me More than that, and actually, I happen to like Prohibition era drinks. Something I picked up at my father's knee.
You mean God rest his cocktail recipes? You mean?
Yeah, there were two. One was called the 3-mile limit and the 12-mile limit. Have you heard these terms?
I've heard the terms. I've never heard of those cocktails, though.
Yeah, they're rum and brandy concoctions. The 3-mile limit, the Coast Guard was founded, you know, maybe 3 years before Prohibition. And you could go out 3 miles and be in no man's land in the eyes of the law.
It was international waters at that point, right?
Yeah, you're in international waters. And so people would set up party boats. And you want to talk about bordellos and bars and gambling establishments, well, they became ships out at sea that were cities of vice, little mini Las Vegases floating 3 miles off the shore, and people would take a 20-minute steamboat ride out to them. So the Coast Guard's still trying to figure out how to do their job, and 4 or 5 years into Prohibition, they made it the 12-mile limit and essentially quadrupled the area of sea that the Coast Guard was supposed to be patrolling, making it even easier for nautical rum runners to do their job because they would spread out that much more. Another interesting thing is that American Prohibition, as opposed to, say, Canadian Prohibition at that time, or even current day, Canada still has Prohibition in the Northern Territories. American Prohibition didn't illegalize possession. And
just distribution?
Yeah, just distribution.
That's why moonshine was a thing, right?
Moonshine.
Or bathtub whiskey, I guess, or what, bathtub something, gin, something like that.
Those things have different roots.
Yeah, and production was still illegal, too. I believe you couldn't make it.
Okay.
Yeah. Actually, hard liquor, it's still illegal, technically. To make hard liquor. You can make...
In our country, not Clatous.
Oh,
I admit I have not looked into making my own hard liquor.
Your current country, my friend, is one of the few that allows hobbyist distilling.
Wow.
I did not know this.
Yes. But the reason that was written in was more for the rich people, because establishments like the Harvard Club, which prophetically the Boston Harvard Club, actually stockpiled 14 years of liquor leading up to the implementation of the Volstead Act. So if you were in the right social class, you were legally allowed to drink from the stockpile, and you could actually write out the whole noble experiment, as it was called at the time. which is funny. Currently, the northern provinces of Canada, where they have Eskimos, mm-hmm. have prohibition, and disastrously, possession is outlawed. And can you imagine why it's disastrous?
It's the same issue I would imagine that we have with Prohibition-era gangsters. You, by outlawing something that there's a very, very clear demand for, and I would imagine up there the area is fairly hard to patrol, you end up creating a criminal class, and opportunistic people are going to serve that market.
Yeah, so, but the reason why possession... The problem the Canadian Northern Province have with possession is this. If you take as an example, and I saw this on a Vice News reel, Vice News did a special on this. A liquor runner will, say, go to South Canada and pick up a bottle of Smirnoff, which is a Connecticut vodka, and that'll cost $75, transport it north, and now it's worth $575. But possession's illegal, so when he sells it, they have to drink it all in one blast.
Wow.
So it creates a binge drinking, which has all those negative effects on the consumer at that point. Because now, instead of having a drink, you have to have 25 because you don't want to get caught owning the thing.
Well, I live in Arizona, and the Navajo and Apache reservations are very nearby. And as anyone who knows anything about modern or even historical Indian culture in the United States, alcoholism is a massive, massive problem among Native Americans. So I would imagine the same is, true of indigenous Canadians as well. I mean, I know it's a big problem in Alaska, so it has to be a big problem in Canada as well.
They do have a drinking problem.
getting back to the sexual revolution, or the first sexual revolution, and then our connection to the second one, what do you think the legacy of the first sexual revolution up to and through Prohibition, what do you think that legacy was, and how did it set the stage for someone like Hugh Hefner?
Oh, the legacy was what the character Tom in The Great Gatsby called the problem of the modern woman. You know, I don't know how familiar you are with the novel, but
I read it a long time ago.
Yeah, the character Tom was against the modern woman, which was she could drink and smoke and vote and have her own affair, which was really Tom's problem, we find out later.
So you believe that the fact that women were less disenfranchised,
yeah,
if we put it that way.
It was a watershed moment for women's disenfranchisement because of what male culture was, male working class culture was, where men were expected to work hard, labor hard, and were given the privilege of drinking hard. And now the woman's domain was now allowed to penetrate the public drinking sphere. That was a watershed event.
So now we're getting into sexual politics and really gender politics as well, I would imagine, right? We're not, I mean, at this stage, trying to understand where the sexual revolution of the 60s really came from, we have to probably understand where the ability for women to have some sort of power for themselves, as opposed to the only power they were given was to serve the men in their lives.
As homemakers.
Now, first off, I would like to point out that much of what we're talking about, in my opinion anyway, much of what we're talking about when it comes to how women were, they were just seen as wives and mothers and that's all they did. That was a social perception, but the reality was that many women, in fact, almost every woman who was not comfortably middle class was forced to work for their living, even if their husbands were also gainfully employed, because poverty being what it was, at least in the United States, it forced women into sweatshops, it forced them into the fields, it forced them into all sorts of day-long labor. And that was primarily, that's what they did all their lives. And they were also responsible for their children and for cooking and cleaning at home. So I think it's probably a good idea to point out that much of what we're talking about was social perception. But the reality, a lot of women, probably somewhere in Prohibition era, probably looked at these guys who worked all day, worked really hard, were allowed to drink, were allowed to party, and said, I've worked all day. Where's my time off?
That's a really good point.
That is an excellent point, actually. But are you calling it pre-1920s Victorian woman as a homemaker only a myth, Lawson Bronx?
I think it's an archetype. I think you can always go back and find tons and tons of examples that support it. I also think that reality doesn't always reflect social perception.
I strongly agree.
For example, and not to get super political, but the political landscape in the United States is quite fractious right now. We have a president who was voted in and many people don't like him right now. We have other people that are in great support of him. But in point of fact, most of the people that I speak to on a daily basis in the United States are not feeling fractious. They're not angry at everybody. They're not fighting all the time. Much of what our social perception is isn't necessarily reflected on the ground. You know, at ground level, we're not really that way. That just seems to be how we see ourselves. And I think much of our perception of history is a reflection of social perception and not necessarily reality. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it makes a lot of sense. And I'm right with you. I think I've always kind of hated history class in school because of that reason. You know, it was just so... It was always such a blanket statement being made, you know, it was always like everyone at this time was exactly like this. And you just kind of knows in the back of your head that that's not everybody's experience. And when people look back at even people looking back at the 80s and 90s now, they characterize it in a certain way. And I was growing up, so maybe I wasn't aware of certain things, but certainly in the 90s, I was lucid. And a lot of the cliches about that just aren't, you know, it's just like that wasn't my experience. It's just. Yeah, it's inaccurate.
Yeah, I've had that experience when they released 80s albums.
Yeah, exactly.
The K-Tel variety. Yeah, like, that wasn't what it was like.
Well, even things, you know, not to rag on the 80s anymore, because I hated the 80s, but, you know, even things like fashion. I mean, they'll show women's with the big hair and the jackets with the big shoulders and, you know, and portray that as average 80s fashion. And I can tell you for a fact, back in the 80s, when you saw a woman dressed like that, you laughed out loud even back then because it looked silly even then. Yes, it might have been quote-unquote fashionable, but the average woman never wore clothes like that, except maybe on a dare or going out with their friends and they really wanted to doll up and look modern. Or, quite frankly, the women I knew never dressed like that. Again, we look at that and that's the 80s. That's what we see is the 80s. You know,
my high school scene, you know, was deeply populated by big hair girls with hair dryer shrunk corduroy jeans.
Again, there's going to be certain fashions and stuff like that. But I've also seen tons of photos from the 50s and 60s. You know, these characters that, you know, since we know it's from the 50s, we would call them greasers. But if you said it was from the 70s, you could have said they were outlaw biker gang. If you said it from, you know, the 80s, they were punks. You know, you could assign anything
and
you
yet
want
I read someplace once that the poodle skirt was a complete mythological construct. That just wasn't fashionable to have poodle skirts in the 50s.
So, again, I'm not saying that our perception of flappers is inaccurate, because I think on some level, it doesn't really matter how many of them there actually ever were, right? Or how many women were flappers, how many women were taking back their sexuality and becoming more in charge of their own lives and destinies and their bodies. There was a social perception that this was happening, and that's all that mattered, you know, because a housewife in Oakland, California might read about all this great stuff that's going on in the speakeasies in New York and say, look at her, you know, she looks great. I wish I could look pretty good, you know? That wouldn't be bad. And that sticks in her mind. And from that point on, she sees the world a little bit differently, you know? And so does everybody else. I'm saying the housewife. But so does everyone else. They look at the world a little bit differently because they see a media that is saying, this is now happening. This is now the new normal. And we all sort of agree with it. You know?
And to think about fashion and the new normal is a famous personality from this era was Coco Chanel.
And look at the empire that arose from that sense of fashion and sense of what a woman deserves and what a woman should have, and a woman should have what she wants. You know.
Yeah, yeah. And her biggest first move was, you know, we're talking about bringing a man's world to the women, and they show the same privilege. And her biggest move was the adaptation of pants by women horse riders was her first big move.
Just on pants, I remember that I think it was Lauren Bacall in the 30s who very famously went about with very fashionable pants. Was it Lauren Bacall? Might have been Katharine Hepburn.
Yeah.
Who wore pants in public, and it was like, wow, that is so daring, because only like 10 to 15 years before, women were being arrested for wearing pants in some cities. So,
wow.
You know, it's astounding to think of it, you know, and there were women,
astounding.
There were women doing that in the 1800s, like 18, you know, the 1890s, because they were suffragettes and they were fighting for that. So, you know, it was part of a dialogue that it took a long time. It took decades, but it was part of a dialogue, a social dialogue, you know, that ultimately culminated in a different sort of social acceptance of normality for the sake of women and their lives and their sexuality. I honestly wish that right now we had a female perspective on all this. It is.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I feel kind of weird about us. I mean, I don't usually think that, oh, we should invite someone else onto this show because it's been established that this is the show.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
at the same time, when discussing something so technically without, you know, outside of our domain, I think that it probably would have been a good idea, but it didn't occur to me until just now. So,
well, why don't we just say this, that it's entirely possible we have absolutely no idea what we're talking about. So
yeah.
We'll just
you are,
go
after
with
all,
that.
Lowly men.
you know.
Well, I mean, I'm afraid that I'm still not, and I'm not even sure what we're talking about at this point. I'm still not clear on what we're discussing. But the one thing that I will say is I don't know how any of this equates to Playboy having liberated women. That's the problem I have.
Well, wait. Who was talking about Hugh Hefner as a liberator of women? This is news to me.
Okay, liberator of people's bodies.
Okay, that's a little bit more like it. I mean, I wasn't thinking of Hugh Hefner as a great liberated woman. I am fascinated at the idea of the professional call girl as a liberated woman, or as a somehow some kind of a result of woman's liberation.
I mean, I don't think that in order to be, you know, that in order to be modern, someone has to go take off their clothes or sell their bodies. You know, that's not the measure of modernity. But I do think that is an indicator that society has stopped trying to dictate what people can do, and that's important to me.
Well,
but I don't
society
think...
will always dictate what it thinks people can do. That's something that's just not going to ever go away.
Well, by definition, that is society. You know, everyone has an agreement about what is proper and appropriate.
One of the statements I didn't touch on and did happen, you know, outside of the show, maybe we should bring it in, was that I don't think that I personally could survive in, say, the 50s or the 40s.
Yeah,
personally.
It would have been rough. Yeah, agreed.
You know, because I am a very, God damn it, I'm just honest and out there. And I honestly blame my sexuality for my lack of success in the corporate world.
But
I
you know
honestly
what?
Do.
You know what though, DB? Because I used to think the same thing. Like you know, I went through the typical thing where it's like, oh, it'd have been so cool to live back then because look at how they dressed and how they talked. And then later I was like, oh, you know what? I would have hated it because it was just it's just so oppressive. But then I went to film school and I saw some avant-garde films by people like, you know, Ginsberg and Burroughs and other people like that, and you do get the idea that there was like this, you know, there was an underground, and I guess there always will be an underground, ideally, and yeah, I don't know how real it was or what it was like or how inviting it was, but I mean there were people doing what they wanted underneath the surface, and that brings me some hope.
And yeah. See, there we go, because Hefner brought about something that had been underground. It had been under the surface. I mean, pornography had been a big business before then, and big business.
Yeah, absolutely.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
You know, but he brought it out into the light. Now, I guess the question I'm having, I'm not certain how I feel about it. I guess I can see a bunch of different sides to this thing. But I guess my question is, was it necessarily a bad or a good thing that this happened? I feel for society in general, it was a good thing, okay? Because I think it opened up our dialogue. It made us question. I mean, we're having this conversation right now because of this, right? So I think it's a good thing to always be able to talk about this because it's something that happened and it was important. It was an important moment. Until Deep Geek brought this subject up, it had never occurred to me that this was not this lightning moment where everything changed. But in point of fact, he was probably the last major element of that change that began during Prohibition, during the Flapper era. He was probably the tail end of that and not the beginning of this new movement. You know, the new movement came afterwards. You know, it's like, as that cartoon, as he said it was, where people say, I guess we're doing this now, or I guess we can do this now. Basically, I think that was the door finally opening, and everything that came afterwards, that's a new era. But I wouldn't necessarily say Hefner ushered in the era. I would say Hefner was the final moment of the previous one. But that's just how I'm thinking right now.
That could be a very good point, because when I think of Playboy magazine, I think of it as a literary magazine. That's my personal perception of it. And that actually goes back to my enjoying reading the interviews and the articles and the advisor column. And it had an editorial content that I just thought was utterly amazing. And I remember distinctly leaving school and having all my P.O. box mail forwarded to my parents' house. And here comes, you know, amongst the other anarchistic madness that entailed, a copy of Playboy magazine that had left my mother apoplectic. and eventually I just pulled out, she was an artist, and I pulled out one of her X-Acto knives, as we argued, and I literally cut the nudes out of a copy of Playboy and said, "Here, you happy? I'm going to go read the articles now."
Well, no, I mean, I wouldn't argue that Playboy did not have good editorial content, at least from what I've read in compilations, like Kurt Vonnegut, Hunter S. Thompson. I've forgotten his name. Thompson. Jeez, since we're all science fiction fans,
we shouldn't forget that Fahrenheit 451 was first serialized alongside of Marilyn Monroe's that first issue of Playboy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I get that they had great. Yeah, Bradbury's one of my, literally, probably my favorite author. Like, he's amazing. I have several of his books. But here's the thing, an old sore.
An old sore in pornography is that when it's illegal, when it has to be underground, is you add redeeming value to it by trying to make it litter or something. So instead of having a girly magazine, you have a book about artistic representations of ladies' lingerie, you know, and is this addition of editorial content the last vestige of dressing up pornographic magazine, or is it actually to say this is a holistic view of men's interest?
Well, even as late as the 1970s, films were being assessed in towns across America, almost every major city, and a lot of smaller ones, second tier cities throughout the country, had those porn theaters, you know, adult movie theaters that people would go to, mostly men. And almost all of them had them, and they were legal in some places, most places. They were legal, but what they were showing, there were restrictions about what kind of pornography could be shown. So you couldn't have something that was purely gratuitous, even up to the 70s, right? That's why there's the old joke about bad acting in porn movies. Because they weren't actors. They didn't hire them for their acting abilities, but there had to be a plot, there had to be dialogue, or else it was considered smut, and it was banned, and they couldn't show it. So, you know, I knew a guy, this is back in Waterbury, Connecticut, where I'm from, and he was a teacher at the local college, and they asked him to sit in on a showing of a porn film that was being shown in this movie theater in town. And he was among a group of other important people in town, and they had to assess the artistic value of this thing, because if it didn't have some kind of artistic value to it, it was going to be banned, and the theater was going to be fined because they broke the law. And this was going on all across the country, and this is all the way up into the 70s, that this sort of perception that sexuality had to have some other framework around it. You know, in other words, it couldn't exist for its own sake. It couldn't be gratuitous.
And yet, that's now turned on its head in a certain way.
Well,
now you have people trying to get an R rating for marketing purposes, which means you're making it into something other than it is to have a so-called worse reputation to bring in the paying customers.
Well, in point of fact, our perception of pornography has changed quite a bit. First off, obviously, people don't see it the way they did back then, but also this need to frame it as some sort of, you know, adjunct to a story, to a plot, to dialogue, that's been thrown out the window, because it is a waste of time. No one watched the movie for that stuff. They watched it for the naughty bits, right? That's what they wanted to see. And that's all they wanted to see, because that's all anybody was ever after to begin with. They didn't feel like there was a need to dress this up. You know, in those days, we were still hung up on the idea that you cannot enjoy it for its own sake. That has largely faded away. But
Do you think because of the internet faded away, lost?
I do, largely. But it was already happening.
Yeah, I agree.
It was already happening, but the internet was a floodgate. It just opened it all up. But yeah, largely, I think it was.
I finally feel redeemed for HPR episode number 69.
It's Taking a while, but you got there.
You got there. You got there.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.